From the BBC in London, this is Meridian.
Hello there. This is Michael Billington. And in the first Meridian of 1982, we're going to look back over some of the key events in all the arts in Britain and worldwide over the past 12 months, and also look ahead to likely trends in the coming year. And to do that, I've got around the table with me Ian Johnston, television producer and film critic, who'll be talking about world cinema in 1981. Edward Greenfield, who'll be covering classical music and opera. Valdemar Januszczak, who'll be looking at developments in the visual arts and popular music. And Margaret Walters, who'll be covering books. I myself will talk about the theatre over the past year. And if I were to risk a generalisation, I would say the amazing thing about the arts this year, certainly in Britain, is how they managed to keep their heads above water. In some cases, rather more than that. A year ago, with the economy in recession, I remember there was a certain despondency, not least because the Arts Council, the major funding body for subsidised groups in Britain, was cutting back on its grants. But in fact, it's been a pretty prolific year for plays, for operas, for art exhibitions, for books, and even, slightly surprisingly, for British films. In tough economic times, the arts also take on, I suspect, an even greater importance in giving life value and purpose. But I don't want to preempt the opinions of our guests, so Ian Johnston, can I ask you first of all, what for you have been the major events in cinema this year?
I'm going to cheat a little, Michael. The best film I saw this year was made 55 years ago. It's Abel Gance's film Napoleon, which he made in 1927. It runs 6 hours long, and it was resuscitated this year with a new musical score by Carl Davis. A wonderful piece of storytelling. I remember Richard Lester, who directed Superman 2 this year, saying, "There are no new tricks since Abel Gance. He knew everything that could be done in the cinema." And my second choice is a cheat as well, because it was all on film but shown on television. It was 11 hours long, and it was called Brideshead Revisited. And this was a totally British operation directed by a man called Charles Sturridge, and it was a supreme piece of storytelling of Evelyn Waugh's novel. And both these events, one at 6 hours, the other at 11 hours, when you top them up, showed that there was no substitute for a good story, even in the cinema. And
was there anything, though, that got a sort of regular cinematic distribution this year that you particularly enjoyed?
Well, I have to mention two British films. One, Chariots of Fire, which was a very strong idea, the idea of one athlete. One athlete is Jew, and he is abjured by his college, and he feels an outsider. The other is a strong Scot Presbyterian who won't run on a Sunday. And a moral dilemma is built up in this film, but unfortunately the writer, Colin Welland, didn't really get hold of his subject, and it wasn't a very well-directed film by Hugh Hudson. It was a good idea. And the other British film, based on a book, The French Lieutenant's Woman, had a screenplay by Harold Pinter, and he tried to use the present day as an interpolation to bring this particular story up to date. But he could have taken a leaf out of the Brideshead book, which is tell the story as the author wrote it, because I think John Fowles did rather better.
Were there any particular performers who leapt out or leapt off the screen this year?
Yes, there was one towering performer I'd not liked in the past, Robert De Niro, who really came into his own in a magnificent effort in Raging Bull, where he played Jake LaMotta, a boxer. He put on 60 pounds to play LaMotta late in life. And this wasn't gimmickry. It was really, one could see how the part permeated through De Niro, and he capped that later in the year when he played a priest in True Confessions. And if I have a slight reservation about the American cinema this year, it is that men of great talent like George Lucas, who made Star Wars, or Steven Spielberg, who this year came up with a jolly good boy's own tale in Raiders of the Lost Ark, are using their supreme cinematographic talents, and they are much, much better, I believe, than anyone we have in this country, to tell, in essence, children's stories. It'd be nice to see them put a little bit of social comment in their films. The best British effort this year in the cinema that I saw was by a director, Ken Russell, who used to work for the BBC, and I thought he put all his arts into one bag and came out very well in a film called Altered States, which was a hypnotic film with a new star, William Hurt, who I think is going to be very popular this year, next year and in 1982, talking about a hallucinogenic mushroom, and Russell was at his very best this year.
Well, very interestingly, Ken Russell, I think, in the coming year, is going to make a great epic film about Wagner, isn't he? And that seems to be the perfect cue to turn from cinema to the world of classical music, and Edward Greenfield, who's with us. Ted, can I ask you, first of all, who were the personalities this year, would you say, in classical music? Who were the figures who dominated the scene?
Well, it's rather hard to say who dominated, but there were certain newcomers. People say, oh, the past is always the great thing, that you that the great figures of the past are not matched by those today. You ought to take note that there are young personalities coming forward, like Ivo Pogorelic, the young Yugoslav pianist who failed to win the Warsaw Prize and turns out to be a great showman, but he's also a great artist as well. And then in England we have someone who could well be the great conductor of the next generation, Simon Rattle, already. He's a magic man, already made a great success in America as well as in England. Everything he touches seems to be right. And this year he was looking after South Bank Summer Music. I think probably the concert scene in London is still pretty conservative in its coverage of the repertory, and it does depend on these personalities.
Did any young composers come through this year very strongly, or do anything significant, would you say?
Well, there are a number of young composers who one ought to mention. I mean, there's a young one in his early 20s called George Benjamin. Then in his late 20s there's Oliver Nussen. Now, Oliver Nussen is somebody I first knew when he was 16 and wrote a symphony which was performed by the London Symphony Orchestra, actually performed in New York as well. Now, he's had great success on both sides of the Atlantic.
What about opera this year? Did you notice anything particular, excitement happening in England or not? Was it a standstill year?
No, not a standstill year. I think we had at Covent Garden, probably the most important thing was the production of the complete Lulu, which I think was very
exciting.
The Alban Berg Lulu, which of course for 40 years has not been done complete, just the two acts, and now the third act has been brought out and completed, and what a transformation it makes. And Covent Garden did that very well, I thought, indeed. But generally, I think the exciting thing in London is that where Covent Garden, with its grand casts and original language productions, has tended to take the lead and the spotlight has been on Covent Garden, this year, I think you'd say that, particularly this last season, since the autumn, the Coliseum, the English National Opera Company, has taken first place, largely because they're no longer doing Johann Strauss and Lehár as part of the mixture, but big things. They've done a new production of Tristan and Isolde. They've resurrected their Fidelio. Marvellous Otello with a superb new singer, Rosalind Plowright, as Desdemona, Pelléas, and then a lot of French opera as well.
So, from what you say, a very sort of busy and active year in the musical field in London, certainly.
Oh, yes. I still think that you can say that London has a wider variety of music making, both in opera and in concerts, than anywhere in the world. And that, of course, partly reflects the fact that we have five full-time orchestras here, which no other city has in that way. And therefore, they're all doing a lot of work separately.
Well, we have, as you say, our concert halls. We also seem to have, particularly in Britain, we seem to have a vast and prolific publishing industry. Every year, more and more books seem to be published. I think the titles this year, I think the number of titles, was about 40,000, roughly speaking, published during the year. Very difficult, of course, to deduce anything from that. But, Margaret Walters, any specific trends you've noticed this year in the book business, in the book world?
I thought that this year that the novels were much more exciting than they had been for a very long time. There was a lot of interest, for the first time that I can remember, in the Booker Prize for Fiction. And I do think that the entries in that were wonderful, and they had a range and an ambitiousness that had become quite rare in English novels, most notably The White Hotel by D.M. Thomas, which is set in Europe before the Second World War, or Salman Rushdie's Midnight Children, which is about the generation of children growing up in India since independence. It's a wonderfully rich and inventive and fantastical novel. The one I think I liked most, though, was by an American-Chinese writer called Maxine Hong Kingston. She lives in Hawaii now, and she'd written a novel about 4 years ago called The Woman Warrior that, again, was a superb book in which she plays with the stories her mother told her about China, explores what it's like to, in a sense, live like a ghost between two cultures. In this one, I thought she was doing something even more interesting for a woman writer. She's addressed this book to her father. It begins with an image of her father working in a laundry in Stockton in California and cursing and rage and frustration. And she speaks to him saying, I'm going to try and imagine your life. And the whole book is that. She goes back to his babyhood in the old China. She imagines his immigration to America. And then goes back beyond him to imagine their grandfather who was working on the railways in the 19th century America, another one who might have emigrated to Hawaii and worked on the sugar plantations, brings it up to almost to the present, imagining the life of a brother, another Chinaman, this time who's drafted into the American army and goes to Vietnam. I thought it was a most moving and stunning book.
It's very interesting. We've heard so much for so many years about the death of the novel, haven't we, at the end of fiction. From everything you say, it sounds as if it's been a very rich year for fiction. But what about non-fiction? I mean, has there been any one book, say, this year that's captured you?
Well, I was most interested in Marina Warner's book on Joan of Arc. It's a familiar subject, of course. I mean, the 15th century French farm girl who somehow gained the ear of the king and marched at the head of the French army against the English, trying to drive them out of France, and then within a year or two was burned at the stake for heresy and treason. Marina Warner looks again at that very remarkable life, asks how it could have possibly happened. But I think in the most interesting part of the book goes on to see what Joan of Arc has meant to people since. It's a book about the way history is written, about the way different generations have reinvented her in their own terms and turned her into a symbol for the most remarkably diverse political and religious attitudes. I mean, she's been a saint, she's been a heroine for socialists, for fascists, for feminists, for people who believe that women should have a traditional role. It's a remarkable book, not just a history book, but, as I said, a book about how history is fashioned.
Is there any new information in the book? Has she uncovered any new facts about Joan of Arc or not?
Yes, I think she did a lot of research. I don't think anybody's looked at the different transformations that the figure of Joan of Arc, and she's done it in art, in literature, in politics, all sorts of things. And again, I thought quite an exciting book.
Well, thank you, Margaret Walters. And now turning from the world of books to that of art and popular music, we've got Valdemar Januszczak, a very versatile critic with us. Valdemar, what about, first of all, the art scene? What has been the major trend, would you say, this year in the art world, particularly in England?
Well, I think what surprised me most is the fact that the big blockbuster's gone on. Last year we had some really huge, very spectacular art exhibitions, notably the Post-Impressionism exhibition at the Royal Academy. And I think most people thought that these expensive exhibitions, we couldn't go on with them. I thought everybody thought we would get down to smaller shows, more intimate exhibitions. And in fact, they've all been proved wrong. Three very notable large exhibitions this year. The first was Edward Hopper, I think, at the Hayward. Now, we in England have always liked Edward Hopper from a distance, but never actually seen very much of him. He's one of these American mythological painters who you always wonder what they'll be like when they finally do make it over here, because in America they have this huge reputation. Their pictures sell for vast quantities of money, and we don't see them because we've never actually been able to afford to buy Edward Hopper paintings. So this large exhibition came over. It revealed an artist who painted a very strange, very silent America, an America completely different to the sort of America we see in the films. There's nothing very fast or flashy about it, and I think most people enjoyed that exhibition tremendously. The Picasso exhibition, which we had here in the summer, was another notable success. I think, personally, it was the most important exhibition of the year. It was called Picasso's Picassos because all the paintings in it were actually drawn from the master's own collection. He'd been secretly saving them, selling off all the pictures that he didn't mind losing, but keeping all the ones that really meant something to him. And all of a sudden, they were unveiled to us in the summer. And what a wonderful exhibition it was. And finally, an exhibition which is still on, which is the Great Japan Exhibition at the Royal Academy. Now, I suspect I'm the only critic who didn't go head over heels about this show, because it's full of the most exquisite objects. Lacquered boxes, beautifully painted screens, those wonderful, delicate Japanese woodcuts. Personally, I felt that what it really lacked was some sort of sense of a real Japan rather than a picture book Japan. I mean, you felt as if everything there was actually for export.
What have you seen, Valdemar, though, on the international scene that you would rate as important?
Well, there are two very important exhibitions abroad. One in Canada, at Toronto, the Art Gallery of Ontario, which was called Gauguin to Moore, and it was a survey of sculpture from the time of Gauguin to Henry Moore, and it focused on the influence of primitivism in sculpture. In fact, it showed how looking at tribal work from the 19th and 18th centuries changed the whole course of modern sculpture. The other show was Westkunst in Cologne, and that was a survey of art from the beginning of the Second World War to the present day, and I think what it set out to do was to show what a profound influence the despair that everybody felt at the outbreak of the Second World War, what a profound influence this had on art, and how that sort of disillusionment, that dissatisfaction with society continued through art right until the present day.
What about popular music? Because I know that's another of your interests, Valdemar. What has been happening in that field, would you say, this year that's been particularly revolutionary or startling?
Well, just in the same way as we've seen a lot of the old masters revived in art, so in pop music, I think we've been going through a series of revivals. It's been quite extraordinary, really. If I was just to list some of the things that have been getting into the popular charts, we've had a rockabilly revival, rockabilly being that sort of a cross between country and western and rock and roll, which they had in America in the late 50s. We've had a psychedelic revival, with groups coming up with these excruciating long names like Echo and the Bunnymen or Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, all very late 60s and psychedelic. We've had Shaking Stevens, of all people. Now, here's someone who's been trotting around the circuits for years, doing sort of copies of Elvis Presley, and rather bad copies at that. Suddenly he's had, I think, 3 number one records this year. Quite extraordinary, the amount of things that have been pulled up, dredged out of the past, and recycled successfully this year.
Have people been buying records as much, do you think, in Britain this year or not? Or is that industry on the decline?
Well, it started off the year, of course, moaning and groaning on about how they are losing all the money to people who are taping records at home and that. But in fact, they've done remarkably well. I think if you look back at the arts in general this year, you'll see that all the people who set out thinking that this year was going to be a huge flop have ended up doing very well. And that goes for the record industry. And I'm sure that you must agree, Michael, that probably goes for the theatre as well.
Well, it does in a way, because again, as I say, a year ago, everyone was predicting gloom and doom and disaster for the theatre. And yet not only has the theatre survived this year in Britain, certainly, but it's come up with some very interesting new work. I think, for me, the test of a good year in theatre is the number of new plays that get done. And this year we've had half a dozen first-rate new plays by living British authors. I won't mention them all, but just one or two. Peter Nichols' Passion Play, which the Royal Shakespeare Company did in January this year, took the oldest subject in the world, bourgeois adultery. What is there left to say about bourgeois adultery? Well, I think Nichols did explore it in detail with the depth that people hadn't done for a very long time. And technically, he had a very interesting idea. He invented alter egos for the two principal characters. So the two main characters were represented by 4 different actors, which was a way of getting across the pain, the guilt, the betrayal that is an inevitable part of adultery. That was, I think, the most moving single play I saw this year. I would like to say something about a play by C.P. Taylor called Good, which again the Royal Shakespeare Company presented in its studio theatre in London. Alas, C.P. Taylor died only a month ago, and he's a very sad loss, because I think Good was a quite remarkable play set in Frankfurt in the 1930s, and it was about the way a decent, honourable, good, middle-class, liberal intellectual who teaches literature becomes absorbed stage by stage into the Nazi Party. And it was a marvellous demonstration, I think, of the self-deluding capacity of the intellectual. So, good year for new plays. I thought also important this year was the way the British theatre, which often tends to be rather insular and parochial, became much more sort of internationally minded. The best thing, for example, that the National Theatre did in the whole of the year, I thought, was a play called The Mayor of Zalamea by the great Spanish dramatist Calderon. We have seen no plays in Britain before from the golden age of Spanish drama. This was the first, and it proved what sort of Shakespearean density and richness was part of this era, and it was a stunningly revived play, I thought.
But surely, I mean, the impression I got that the most important event on the stage this year was actually a musical of all things. I think I'm referring to Cats.
Well, Cats, yes. I mean, it's not often that the British can sort of fling their hats in the air and say they've done a good musical, because on the whole we do musicals disastrously badly. But Cats was an extraordinary show. It was based, as you know, on the T.S. Eliot Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats. And what it did was to try and express the spirit of the poems through song, but more particularly through dance. Again, dance musicals are not something the British do very well. It's an American speciality. But here we had all the dancers dressed in sort of cat costumes with cat masks and trying to express something of those poems through cat movement. The show had a sort of quality of exhilaration, is the only way I can describe it, and yet at the same time seemed to me to stay faithful to what Eliot was trying to do in the poetry. One other dance event I think is of some importance this year, which took place in the field of what one might loosely call classical ballet, and that was at the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden, where The Royal Ballet Company gave the premiere to Kenneth Macmillan's new full-length ballet, Isadora, which was based on the life of the famous revolutionary dancer Isadora Duncan. It was very much about her private life, it was about her love affairs, it was about her sort of tempestuous, disordered life, and it expressed that partly through dance, partly through speech. And I thought it was a marvellous mixture of those two art forms. Ballet purists hated it, the ballet critics kicked it all around the place and trounced it to Kingdom Come. Not being myself a ballet specialist, I thought it was a marvellous and exciting piece of pure theatre, and I do hope it stays in the Royal Ballet repertory, and I do hope it gets seen outside the confines of England as well. So, I mean, it was, I think, as we've all been agreeing, really, around the table, it was a busy year in all our art forms, despite the predictions of disaster early on. One art form we haven't discussed in any great detail is television, though you, Ian Johnston, mentioned Brideshead Revisited earlier on. Since you work in television, how would you characterise the year? I mean, is the feeling in British television one of caution at the moment, or is it one of expansion?
Caution is the word. I don't think it's been a very adventurous year. Two-thirds of all television here, of course, comes from the BBC. The BBC wanted to get a very large increase in its licence fee this year, and some unkind people think that the BBC goes on its best behaviour when it wants an increase, and perhaps things were a little bit more bland than usual. There's a creeping disease in British television which I call Blue Peterism. Now, Blue Peter is a children's hour programme that's been going for 20 years, but it is very conventional, very well behaved. And as the presenters grow up, they then present science programmes and current affairs programmes and, God knows, arts programmes, and bring this same terrible blandness, this dead hand to it. So I'd like to see more adventure. The most exciting thing on British television this year was an American tennis player called John McEnroe, who was very far from bland and used to just blow his top. Perhaps his bad temper is allied to his talent, but it was alive, and it made you realise how exciting television can be. The three misses, putting it cruelly this year, were three assassination attempts, one successful, because President Sadat, the Pope, and Ronald Reagan all have cameras on them wherever they go. Sadat, as we know, was killed, and the other two were injured, but no one saw the actual shot. The cameraman missed it. Those were the misses of the year. But looking at it purely technically, and Britain proudly produced the biggest television programme ever this year at St Paul's Cathedral.
The Royal Wedding. I think you've touched a very important point there. Television's ability to reflect reality. It isn't simply an art form, it is a service, isn't it? Telling us what's going on in the world. Valdemar, did you think it did that job well this year?
Well, I tell you what, watching Brideshead Revisited, I didn't get a sense of reality at all. Revisited, and then revisited again. Interminable programme. Now, I actually believe that there were so many revivals going on. I think just the way we've been talking, this has come across. There were so many things being dug up out of the past this year because I think people lost confidence in our own age, in the present. And Brideshead Revisited was a huge success, of course it was. But the reason why it was a success was because everybody could drift away into this 30s and 40s atmosphere, into this wonderful stately home, into this sort of dreamy boating on the lakes in Oxford thing. And it was quite extraordinary how nobody seemed to want to confront what was going on in our world.
I would take issue with you on that subject, because there was one particular television play this year called United Kingdom, which the BBC did, which was in fact about the possibility of local government establishing some kind of independence, as it were, and the conflict between the police and local government. That did seem to be a totally contemporary play. And I would say in all the arts you could find some example if you look.
It did stick out as an exception, though, didn't it? It wasn't the run of things. It wasn't as if every week on television one was being bombarded with literature or plays written about the present day.
No, I would just argue, though, that I don't think the answers you have been totally escapist and totally nostalgic. I think in all the arts there have been some examples, anyway, of forward-looking and pioneering. But can I just take us on from that to the arts in 1982 and what's going to be happening during the current year? And I'd like to ask each of you in turn what your particular predictions are, or what you know is going to be happening. Ted Greenfield.
Well, my prediction is that the record world tends to lead the music world, the concert world. Perhaps that's the wrong way around, but we're hoping that the compact digital disc will be available in 1982, and I think that will get everyone effervescent again in the music world. In London in particular, with our many orchestras, we're having another Art Centre, and that I think is going to be the major thing in London, the Barbican Art Centre.
Which opens in the City of London in March, doesn't
it? In March, yes. Whether you'll get people to go there, because it's a very grand building with the most marvellous foyers, but it's not exactly in the centre of things, or doesn't feel in the centre of things at the moment, but could well do. It's very beautiful inside.
It will, one should explain, be occupied, partly owned by the London Symphony Orchestra and the Royal Shakespeare Company, and my guess is that those are such strong institutions, they will attract people themselves. But Valdemar, can you offer us any guide as to what might be happening in the art world this year?
Well, I have a feeling we're going to have yet more of the same. I know, for instance, that there will be an exhibition opening at the Tate Gallery, which is our big modern art gallery here in London, of paintings by Queen Victoria's favourite painter, Landseer. Now, Landseer, of course, is best known for his dogs and his rather cute, sentimental scenes of dogs, children, the kind of thing the Victorians loved. Now, what on earth is an exhibition like that doing at the Tate Gallery, the home of, you might have heard of the infamous Carl Andre Brix, the home of modern art in England, and here we are having the sentimental Victorian paintings. I think that everybody is going to start putting even more exhibitions on of things that we know and love from the past. And of course, there is one very major event opening, which is the big Festival of India exhibition series, which starts next summer. And I know there's a very large exhibition on at the Hayward, another one at the Royal Academy. So whereas this year has been Japan year, really, next year I think will be India year here on the art gallery circuit in England.
Ian Johnson, looking at the cinema, can you see any one nation having that kind of dominant effect that Valdemar was talking about in the art world? Are we going to get a year, for example, I don't know, of East European pictures? Because we've had quite a few lately, haven't we, on the international scene?
They're always there, and Vida and people are always making films. But one's talking about a small cinema in London seating 600 people as opposed to the 2 million people in America who sit down and see films. So it's more of the same in the cinema. We're having a Superman 3 and a Star Wars 3. Mentioning India, one of the most anticipated films of the year, opening in March, will be Richard Attenborough's Gandhi. Attenborough's been working hard to perfect his directorial talents in Oh, What a Lovely War and A Bridge Too Far, and has never quite got it right. But in Gandhi, the word, as they say in the film industry, is rather good.
Is it going to be a very long, big blockbuster in terms of size and scale?
Certainly, we've been reading about it all year, and our listeners in India would know better than I, but I think that when Gandhi's funeral was recreated, which they did just outside Delhi, there was something like 250,000 voluntary extras, so I don't think there's a lens big enough to encompass all those.
It was also, of course, a very controversial film in India during its making. It would be very interesting to see whether the doubts that were raised would be answered by the film itself.
That, and what is even more amazing, is that an American film company has paid, I think, $15 million, Columbia, to show it in America. Now, how the traditional cinema goer, the Burt Reynolds, Clint Eastwood fan in the Midwest, will settle down with Gandhi, I don't know.
Margaret Walters, very hard, obviously, to predict what's going to be happening in publishing, but would you like to offer any pointers for 1982?
Well, I think, paradoxically, in publishing, the most promising thing is the looking to the past. I mean, for a long time now, American selling techniques have been dominating publishing here, you know, enormous sums of money paid for a few real blockbusters and everything else goes by the board. What we realised in 1981 was that through, for example, Virago Press, which celebrated its fifth birthday, that there is a terrific market for forgotten novels that are really very good, sometimes only a few years old, sometimes 50 years old. They've published some extremely exciting things. I think that other publishers are beginning to copy them to do the same thing. And actually, I think when that's done, I mean, it's a good ground for future writing. I think it's very exciting, and I think that's going to continue.
And certainly in the theatre, we're looking forward to some excavation, as it were, of the past this year. The National Theatre's reviving the musical Guys and Dolls. Elizabeth Taylor's going to be playing in London in The Little Foxes. Peter Brook's production of Carmen is coming from Paris to London. And Schnitzler's La Ronde, which is now out of copyright, is getting two major productions in January alone. So, who can predict what the arts will be like in 1982? But to find out, I hope you'll join us on Meridian throughout the year. Thank you very much, and a Happy New Year to everyone.